somewhere before 50,000 BC on what was probably the Mid-Atlantic Ridge and other associated land masses in the middle of the Atlantic that were above seawater 60,000, 70,000 years ago. There was the beginnings of a culture that later turned into what we would call Atlantis. But even this is difficult because Casey said, you know, at the beginnings, it was just basically primitive people, you know, but by 50,000 BC, they had reached a quite high level of technology, not the highest, and in a different way. You know, it'd almost be like if we rebooted the simulation of, say, the 19th and 20th centuries, maybe flight would look different. It wouldn't look exactly the way, you know, Wright Brothers propeller jet. It would be like something a little different.
Hi, everybody. This is Mind the Shift, and I am Anders. I am thrilled today to introduce you to Michael LaFlemme. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you so much for inviting me. And let me think. I remember one word or one expression, I think, in Swedish, if that's correct. If I say, jag talar inte svenska, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Mm-hmm. I don't speak Swedish. So that's,
there you go.
It's good that we have this podcast, that we do this podcast in English then.
Yes.
So, yeah. Jag talar inte svenska. I don't know how many, actually, how large a percentage of my audience that are Swedish. I think the bulk of the audience is international, really, from all kinds of countries. Anyway, so you are an independent researcher and an adjunct professor of history and philosophy based in Mexico. Is it Monterrey? Yeah. Or?
That's right. I live in Monterrey at the moment, yep. But I'm from the United States, but I've been living here for a few years, so.
Excellent. So you're also a scuba diver and a guitarist, which is obviously very cool, but you are here because you have written this book here.
Ah, yes.
Visions of Atlantis.
Nice.
Reclaiming Our Lost Ancient Legacy. And I have to say that, and by the way, this book is now number one on Amazon, right?
Yeah, as of a few days ago, it went to number one in prehistory and ancient Egyptian history, actually, in two categories. So that was really cool to see.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. So your book, I must say, is a must read for anyone who's interested in our lost history and our distant past, because it contains everything. I mean, if you want to read only one book about your past, in my opinion, you can very well pick this one. But I guess there are thousands of books about our past, of course. But this is sure. Very, very, very fascinating because you know maybe you've noticed that this podcast raises three big questions, maybe the three biggest questions, you might say. I mean, who are we, or really what are we? Where do we come from, and where are we going? And your book addresses, I don't know how you pronounce that. The first two questions, of course, obviously, but also by implication, it points or it hints towards the future. It's not only about the myths, indications, and evidence about Atlantis, because you really dive deep into paleontology, geology, genetic research, and also some more spiritually oriented sources that offer explanations as to what the heck we humans are. And you refer to basically the whole ancient civilization crowd among independent researchers, of which quite a few have been guests on this podcast, actually.
That's right.
And you talk about the Younger Dryas cataclysm theory, of course, and you talk about the anomalies of the Giza pyramids. And as I read, you know, every time I came up with a question, you gave me an answer just a chapter or two later on. So,
well, that's really cool because it's actually everything you said was kind of my intention as somebody who had been thinking about this topic for you know, probably 8 or 9 years before the book came out. I probably wrote it in 2 years, but looked at all the research that I could find that interested me, like you mentioned, like the work of Christopher Dunn, for example, whose books I had read 10 years ago. And, you know, these things kind of just go in the back of your head. And then you read dozens and dozens and dozens of other books. And, you know, some of them I thought were incredible, but they were super specific. And I didn't feel like, when I was explaining a lot of these theories to some of my friends, for example, when you're taking, you know, extremely technical data from oceanography or from Christopher Dunn's work or from, you know, paleontology and things like this, I wanted to write something that really synthesized the bulk of the best data on not just Atlantis, the question of Atlantis, but the question of, you know, possibility of a civilization in remote antiquity. But then where I wanted to take it a step further was by engaging seriously with remote viewing and clairvoyant evidence, and doing it not in a way that was just saying, well, Edgar Cayce said this in a reading, because, you know, that's not how you present evidence that's, you know, contrary to the materialistic paradigm that 90% of researchers in this, you know, historical world or more go by, who just categorically deny things like remote viewing or channeling, even though both have been scientifically studied. They're not, I wouldn't even argue, you know, there's nothing woo-woo about it. It's just an extremely rarefied skill that very few people can perform. But I picked people that couldn't have been influenced by, say, popular culture or subconscious intimations, you know, because if I say today, I'm channeling a vision of Atlantis and, you know, it's like, well, I've already seen Star Wars. I've already seen Indiana Jones. I've already seen all sorts of things that could subconsciously influence me. But when you see, for example, you know, Frederick Oliver's book, A Dweller on Two Planets, which he channeled clairaudiently, not in a trance, just through, he claims, voices in his head told him to write this book, which again, I understand how on the surface sounds incredible, but I urge people, well, read that chapter because it's not fake. It was a book that was channeled in 1882. And the things he described did not exist in 1882. And so there's only two possibilities. One, a kid for no reason, for no profit, spent 3 years writing a 400-page internally coherent saga whose data points actually line up with recent discoveries geologically, and then put it in a box and died before it was ever published. And in that story, he's talking of, in, this is in 1882, he's talking about holographic cell phones. He's talking about cigar-shaped objects that can travel in the air and underwater. He's talking about zero-point energy fields. He's talking about basically things that, you know, Tesla would later perfect and, you know, invent on some level. But he's saying this before Tesla, you know, or at the very latest, like when Tesla was in his infancy with these things. And he was not exposed to it as a 17-year-old kid who will work with miners in, you know, the Wild West.
It's wonderful that you just dive into that central part piece of the book right away. And let's get back to Frederick and also to Edgar Cayce. Yeah. But let me begin, or we have already begun, of course, but let me continue by asking you now, I mean, a philosophical question. Isn't it a bit outrageous in a way that we don't know where we come from? I mean, that should be our birthright, shouldn't it?
Well, you know, I think that's another thing that kind of became a central theme of this book, you know, which is like, to me, almost like a house of leaves or something. It's like, it's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside, this book, you know, because yes, it is ostensibly a book about Atlantis and pre-Platonic sources and, you know, how the actual story was, you know, told and how it evolved through Western civilization, because that's my, you know, profession as an intellectual historian, to trace intellectual developments. But then as I got into the readings, you realize that in the work, for example, of Edgar Cayce, as he's describing the, you know, three iterations of Atlantis, you know, the oldest going back more than 75,000 years, which is, even for me, incredible to conceive. And there's not much detail on what's going on in the earliest iterations, but it became a kind of study of, well, what else did he say about the soul or the first, you know, metastasis of conscious beings in the third dimension? And what else did he say about, you know, where the soul or consciousness goes afterwards? You know, because a lot of his readings were past life readings. That's how the subject of Atlantis first came up with Edgar Cayce, was people asking him, well, I'd like a life reading, not just a medical reading. The majority of his readings were helping people that had severe illnesses and spinal deformities and things. And he actually, you know, gave over 14,000 readings, and only about 500 of them ever mentioned lost civilizations like Atlantis or Lemuria or a handful of other ones. So yeah, the book did become almost like a, you know, personal investigation. I wanted to know myself. And, you know, it became clear that not just Cayce, but Oliver and basically anybody that was channeling this subject all said the same thing, that, you know, a lot of the consciousnesses that were around during the final destruction of Atlantis around, let's say, 10,000 BC are back in the 20th century and 21st. And that is why the subject had become so popular again in the late 19th century, as we were recovering, according to Frederick Oliver, the technology we used to have.
Okay, so the souls that are reincarnating in this era, then, from that time.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it makes sense in a couple ways. It makes sense because, you know, if you were to even, let's say, try to explain, as I mentioned, I think in the fifth chapter of the book, if you were to explain what we are using right now to Thomas Jefferson, it wouldn't even make sense.
No.
Let alone would he believe. It wouldn't even make sense. So I think this subject, almost by the natural weight of its own, you know, how would I even explain? By the kind of just natural progression of how information is received by the masses, it's almost like the story had to stay asleep until people were ready to have reference points in their own life. Mm. You know, even in Frederick Oliver's time in the late 19th century, he's writing before flight. The only flight he has at the time are, you know, zeppelins or balloons. And yet he's describing things that, you know, we would call, you know, UAPs today.
Yeah.
Before their wide sighting, you know, where you have reliable reports of cigar-shaped objects coming out of the ocean.
It's lying. Well, which incidentally is something that is coming out right now. I mean, the last couple of years, there have been a lot of accounts
and it leads to, you know, the question of, you know, are we dealing, as, you know, Richard Dolan, one of my favorite researchers, always says, like, who are we to presume these are necessarily extraterrestrial?
You know, could be us, maybe returning
could
from
be us. Or, could or be from, a breakaway
from the past or from the ever existing present.
Exactly. It could be some sort of echo from that timeline, or it could be just simply a breakaway civilization that
bleed through from another dimension, perhaps, or something like that.
Sure. And, you know, even regarding the just pure technological, you know, developments that Cayce was describing, or that how Oliver described their civilization worked, you know, they were talking about, you know, using pre-crime. I mean, in 1886, there's no
Minority Report. Yeah.
No, I mean, he's describing a scene in that book that's Minority Report. And he's saying, you know, we're using magnetic brain re-entrainment to, you know, solve criminality in this district of Atlantis in the capital city. And it's like, okay, where is this kid getting this information? But see, what I wanted to do was, I basically wrote it as a kind of like, I split both sides of my personality. One side said, you know, I want this to be an exciting, engaging read. The other side of me said, I want to point by point try to refute my own research. And so that's what I did with every statement from the first source to the 450th footnote. I said, I'm going to sit there and try to prove that, you know, this is just a figment of your imagination, or this source couldn't be talking about this, you know. And I spent a lot, that's why the book took so long, was because, you know, I said to myself, okay, let's actually look when Frederick Oliver says, for example, you know, this is a sketch of what the capital principal city and what the principal island landmass looked like. So he drew a sketch. And I would do things like look at a map of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. And to my incredible surprise, I actually found the region he was sketching. And so I said to myself,
I was looking at that yesterday, actually, on Google Earth. And it's, I mean, the area around the Azores.
Yes.
If you turn it a little bit, it looks almost exactly like his sketch.
It is exactly like. In fact, I have actually put a traced, like, superimposed paper over it, and it is exactly that.
Yeah.
And so I asked myself, okay, that's undeniable. Now, the question is, in 1882, was there an accurate map, contour map, of that region? No, there was not. There was one map from 1877 when they discovered the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, and it was just soundings with numbers. So that's real. That's not a you know, supposition. That's not a, you know, oh, he was describing electricity and we have no, this is, he's sketching a physical contour of the bottom of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge when no such area was known, let alone
As far as I recall, the highest mountaintop of that on that map that he sketched is actually, it matches the Pico in the Azores.
Mount Pico,
the highest mountain in the Azores, I think.
Again, these are more than just statistical random anomalies. He says the highest point was called Pitach Rock.
The southeast of the island, yeah.
And it's exactly where Mount Pico is. He also said in the beginning of his story, I'm climbing an active volcano. Well, Mount Pico is a stratovolcano. You know what I mean? And it's like, it's not just that. I mean, for example, he says at one point when they're coming back on their craft from a diplomatic mission to India, and he goes, we're coming back. And they stop at all these different places on the world to sightsee, him and his team. And at one point he says, you know, we're passing, this was written in 1884, bear in mind. He says, we're passing over the Amazon. And he says, you know, you think the Amazon is a pristine jungle and a wilderness, but it's not. He goes, we cultivated this 10,000 plus years ago. And all these, you know, fruits and trees you see here were imported from Atlantis. Well, in 2019, they determined that somebody had been farming in the Amazon since at least, you know, 9,000 plus years ago. And then indeed, there is evidence that they brought these plants, as I quote, from somewhere else. And it's like, once these data points start lining up, just from that book, for example, it's beyond a statistical, you know, improbability that this is all just this is not coincidence.
Yeah.
This is on some level. And I say, okay, so what are the conclusions? I can't prove. Nobody can prove if the kid was, you know, he was a real person. We have a birth certificate, a death certificate. But, you know, did he have a secret contributor? Well, that's even stranger, because then somebody else knew this. And how did they get that information in 1882?
Yeah.
You know, the book, we know the book was finished no later than 1886 from chain of custody records. And then it was formatted and copywritten and not released until he died in 1899. But it was really published in 1905, but didn't even get into the public's knowledge until 1920. But the manuscript was completed. No, I'll put it even at the furthest, 1898. Well, we didn't have any of this knowledge in 1898. We didn't even have that map.
Of course not.
So to me, you know, these are not just kind of, as I mentioned before, and I mean this not in an insulting way, but these aren't just, you know, lighting incense and meditating with, you know, crystals with a neon sign outside of your, you know, storefront, which again, I'm not even making fun of people that do tarot card readings. Real tarot card readers and real astrologers have actually shown some very interesting information. But I'm saying this isn't like Miss Cleo said that Atlantis had flying machines. This is, look, this is just as important as any other data. Because what it does is it fills in missing pieces from, say, pre-Platonic records of Atlantis, which, you know, exist, which, again, I always tell people when people say, well, this whole story started with Plato. It's like, no, it didn't. Read the 12 pre-Platonic sources that I cite before this. They're not as detailed, but that is simply not true that the story begins. I mean, even in Plato's story himself, he would say the story doesn't begin with me. It begins with Solon, who got it from Egypt. Mm-hmm. You know, the story of Atlantis.
Let's get back to the sources in a minute here. I just want to, before we delve deeper into the details of this fascinating story of our ancient history, Atlantis is the ultimate human myth, I would say, and then it has to be pointed out that myth does not equate not true, because many truths are come That's in right. the form of myths, of course. But so how did this fascination start in your life for you? Was it, I mean, you mentioned before the interview that you managed to raise $1 million from Kanye West at one point, and your boss stole the money and you ended up homeless. Was that the pivotal point that got you into this, or was it much earlier than that? I'm sorry, I just had to ask about that because you mentioned that story.
I did. Yes, that is a true story. There's pictures of it on Google. You can check those out. I think by the time that happened, I had actually already been about 6 years into my own research. Because I remember talking about, actually, the person who stole that money was very interested in Atlantis and was a huge supporter of this book, believe it or not. He just had other ideas of how to appropriate other people's money. But I think, you know, it's weird. I remember reading Ignatius Donnelly's book, The Antediluvian World. And
how old were you then?
Yeah, I remember reading that about 10 years ago, and just, you know, I think like everybody, I as a, you know, historian who was a history professor at a university, you know, you're aware of Atlantis, you're aware of, you know, I had, you know, watched and documentaries with Robert Bovall. I was always just kind of open-minded person with a lot of issues that my colleagues were not open with. But like most people, I just thought nothing of it. I just thought either it's completely a fiction that Plato used as a kind of allegory to reaffirm his vision of an idealized heroic Greek city-state, which I had no problem with, you know. But to my great surprise, when I actually read the dialogue, you know, because Donnelly excerpts part of it. But I remember sitting there reading the actual dialogue, and I was struck by, I mean, first of all, one of the first things he disclaims, I forget if it's in Timaeus or Critias, but he says, as strange as this, it's Critias talking to Socrates. He says, as strange as this story is, Socrates, every word of it is true. It's vouched for by Solon, the wisest of the seven sages. And then as you actually read the account, it has none of the components of a myth. The reason we call it a myth is just because of the timeline. But if that timeline was about 3,000, 5,000 years earlier, no one would look at that story as a myth any more than they would look at the story of, you know, say, the Iliad as a myth today, because we now know that Troy was real. You know, Heinrich Schliemann dug up Troy in the 19th century. We know that's real. Nobody would say, maybe there are obviously mythical elements to it. But who's even to say at the end when it says, and Zeus convened a meeting of the gods? I mean, they're not using the same monotheistic word God that we use, you know? And it could just be like, you know, Paul Wallace and Mauro Baglino remind us all the time with the word in the Bible, you know, where it's Elohim. You know, and with the Greek gods, it's the same thing. It's a pantheon of powerful beings. We don't know really who they are. So even these things, we have to be careful when it says, you know, in Benjamin Jowett's translation, you know, Zeus convenes a meeting of the gods. And immediately you're pre-programmed to think of the Sistine Chapel. And, you know, but it's like, just change that word. Even. You know, Zeus convenes a meeting of the powerful ones. And they determine that, and then it cuts off, you know. But I say it has none of the elements of a myth because, I mean, in a myth, you don't describe the dimensions of the canal locks in the circular city. That doesn't, you know, why would you need that? That's not in, you know, another foundational myth, technically. It's not necessary. Why would you describe the types of materials used in all the causeways and the, you know, bridges? Why would you describe they had baths for horses on this end of the island and baths for king? It actually has all the descriptions of a first-hand account of a real place.
You know,
and it's situated in Plato's dialogue unequivocally in front of the Straits of Gibraltar.
Yes,
which is exactly where the Azores.
Pillars of Heracles or Hercules.
The Pillars of Heracles, which are the Straits of Gibraltar, and it's incredible how people have played with that fact and made the Pillars of Hercules. I've seen everywhere from, you know, the straits between Sicily and Libya or Malta or the Baltic, or, you know, it's actually talking about the Black Sea. And it's like, find me any other case in ancient history where the Pillars of Hercules ever signified anything but the Straits of Gibraltar, you know, and I'll wait. I'll wait for my $1 million back too, you know, because I'll more likely get that than you find what I just said, because it doesn't.
Many
even
say that it's the explosion of the volcano at Thera, called Santorini today in the Greek archipelago. But that was, I think, 1500 BC or something. And that actually happened, but
it did.
It doesn't fit in any other parts of the account.
That's right. And I'm not denying that, you know, that Bronze Age event absolutely happened and absolutely was recorded in multiple sources, I think quite reliably, and destroyed Minoan civilization, which I would argue was a remnant of, you know, the final Atlantean civilization rebooted. Just like the Phoenicians and other cultures eventually took on aspects of that. But in the seminal account, Plato's very clear. It's a large island, which is an empire, just like England is an empire, you know, that had dominion over the entire Mediterranean. He describes exactly where, parts of North Africa, Italy, up to Egypt. That's what Plato says. Centered on a large island landmass, west of the, in front of, as he says, well, however you want to translate that from ancient Greek, the Pillars of Hercules, which is basically where the Azores, you know, mid-Atlantic ridge basin is today after sea level rise at the end of the Younger Dryas period. The other thing is, in Edgar Cayce's account, and this is where I think the book is unique, you know, you realize, because Cayce was, you know, much more thorough in his channeled messages than Plato was, because he's talking about 70,000 years of Atlantean history, whereas Plato's talking about the final, let's say, century. He doesn't exactly say, he just describes the fall, but we don't really know what iteration he's describing. I would argue he's describing the final iteration, which Edgar Cayce says had been originally a huge continent, basically the majority of the mid-Atlantic basin, which, again, if it sounds incredible, I urge everybody, go to my website, go to michaelleflem.com and look at the second picture, which is a map of the Atlantic Ocean with the water drained. And you see that the middle of the Atlantic Ocean is not an empty desert. It's actually, the Atlantic Ocean is more properly understood as a giant bisected basin. Yeah.
Two basins, one easterly,
exactly,
and one westerly.
The largest mountain range in the world is actually the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. It's just underwater. And so you can see the outlines of an enormous landmass that perhaps, as Dr. Bruce Heason, who was, you know, one of the people that discovered the Mid-Atlantic, you know, and mapped the Mid-Atlantic Ridge more thoroughly in the 20th century, said, we can't explain certain things. We're taking soundings, in one case, 3,000 miles from shore. And yet we are finding freshwater diatoms and sand deposits that had to have been part of a beach. He said himself, and Maurice Ewing, they said, look, this doesn't make any sense, because even if the Wyoming, you know, melting and everything carried beach sand from North America, it couldn't have gone 3,000 miles into the Atlantic Ocean without melting first. So he says it's our actual belief that this used to be dry land 10 to 12,000 years ago.
Yeah, that was pretty far south, wasn't it? Outside between Brazil and Africa.
That's right.
Yeah.
Correct. So, I mean, there you have oceanographic evidence. You know, also, there's other strange anomalies. You know, Plato said, you know, there were a lot of elephants. He casually just mentions that on the island of Atlantis, you know. And again, I show that in the oceanographic chapter when they were digging posts for radar stations and things like this for the military, you know, hundreds of miles from shore for things like oil rigs and things like that. When they took silt deposits, they did. They found, you know, mastodon teeth and, you know, things like this. And they said, well, it's our estimation that, you know, elephants roamed the far edge of the continental shelf. Probably 10 to 50,000 years ago. And then you find an Edgar Cayce reading before this was even mentioned in the 30s. And he says the continental shelf used to be the lowlands of the continent of Atlantis when it was still a continent before its first of three destructions. You know, the first being in 50,722 BC. The second being 28,000 BC, and the final sometime around 10,500.
Yeah.
Which again, I don't claim to know exactly what was going on at these dates. You know, I'm just a reporter showing you, look, a man who had a 99% accuracy rate with almost everything he ever said in his life.
Yeah, and the mainstream doesn't have a clue anyway. So, I mean, you could just as well go with what Cayce and Oliver say about this.
Right. And I like to show people that, look, you know, the idea that there's no evidence, not just for Atlantis, but for other anomalies all over the world of, like Christopher Dunn says, you know, if you still think that the, you know, Great Pyramid was a tomb for Khufu, I mean, what planet are you living
on? Yeah, come on.
You know, come on.
So you mentioned Plato, of course, because Plato is the most well-known source that everybody is referring to, but you also in the book show that, as you've already said here, that there are several sources before Plato and several also quote-unquote accepted historical sources after Plato. We don't have to mention all of them now, but then you have also these two, those two sources that the mainstream probably would dismiss as too strange, and you have mentioned them several times. You have Frederick Oliver and Edgar Cayce. I would say that Cayce is probably fairly known among many people. I knew about him, but Frederick Oliver was a new reference to me. So tell us a little bit about those two characters and when they lived and how they were able to come up with this. I mean, supposedly channeling information from entities that supposedly were, I mean, incarnated as humans during the Atlantean era.
Right. Well, Frederick Oliver comes first. You know, when he wrote this, he was a 16-year-old boy living in Eureka, California, on the, you know, frontier, the Wild West, who, you know, was a miner, worked for a mining family. His family were prospectors, and according to him in his preface to this manuscript that became the book A Dweller on Two Planets, he claims to have received voices in his head from a consciousness that told him, sit down and dictate my life story through your body. My name is Philos. I had a past life in Atlantis in the year 11,160 BC. Again, interesting date to randomly, quote-unquote, pick. And in this story, it tells the story of this kid who was this consciousness who told the story through this kid, Frederick Oliver, of what it was like. And it is the most incredible story. And you can go to my website, and at the bottom, you can scroll through it. It's a public, open-source book. In fact, I cite the court case in 1941. There was a court case. Somebody sued him and his family after he died because his family sued somebody else because they said, you guys are ripping off our book. You know, because I think his mom still thought it was a fictional book. She couldn't believe her son was truly in touch with something. And the judge said, no, this is a legitimately channeled source and it has open rights, just like the Bible or the Book of Mormon. Read it, mom. So I found that funny that, legally, anybody can share that book. So I have a copy of it on my website if you want to scroll through it. But it's an incredible story because it's the story of Atlantis when it was reduced to this final island called Poseidon, which again is very interesting because that's what Casey called Atlantis. He called it Poseidon, the principal island, Poseidon, the other islands being Og, and in many cases he has different names for different timelines. But the final principal landmass that I believe Plato was talking about was not Atlantis, which is the, you know, for lack of a better word, the empire, the theme, the culture. It was the island of Poseidon. And it's very important to kind of wrangle in all the various, you know, discussions people have. Is it a continent? Is it an island? And I show people, look, it was, according to Casey, a much larger continent that stretched from basically Cuba to Spain and had archipelagos and access to, you know, both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. And the Atlantic Ocean was much more navigable because of that. You didn't have wide expanses like Columbus had to cross, for example. But the account that the Egyptians told Solon, who told Critias, Critias' grandson, who told Plato, was the final island, which after three destructions, according to Casey, had been reduced to this fin-shaped triangular place where the Azores Basin is today. That Frederick Oliver
with the size of like Spain plus France or something like that.
Maybe? No, pretty big. Yeah, not an insignificant landmass. And in fact, Plato has. You have to go back and be a huge nerd and find out exactly where Libya was according to the Greeks. You know, Libya for the Greeks was basically Northwest Africa, Morocco, Tunisia combined, and then Asia for them would be the Anatolian Peninsula. So he says, you know, in Plato's description, it's about the size of, you know, Libya and Asia combined. Which for them, again, it's really not important because there's still that exact triangular shape that Oliver sketched. And it's exactly where a lot of people, including Ignatius Donnelly, thought the final island of Poseidon was. And so, and again, in Plato's account, when he says Atlantis, and he describes the capital circular city, which again is not the entire civilization. And it frustrates me when people say, I found a circular city, therefore I found Atlantis. It's like, well, if you found London, did you find the British Empire? Mm. You know, the British Empire stretched all over the world.
Which leads us maybe to the question about the Rishat structure. We can ask that now because I was going to do that. What do you make of the Rishat structure? Because that is actually what you're talking about now, that it's called the Eye of the Sahara. It looks,
sure.
I mean, uncannily similar to Plato's description of Atlantis's capital. But I understand, there were many sub empires or sub many kings, and this might have been just one of the capitals, or am I right?
You know, in fact, that's what I even say in that chapter of the book, and I'll let people read because it's a kind of strange chapter to explain on a podcast because there's a lot of geographical technical data. But yeah, I'm one of these people that I really hate the infighting sometimes, not just in this field, but in my main job, which is, you know, teaching World War II history or history of enlightenment or philosophy, where it's like, this is my thing, you know, like I'm the this Atlantis is here guy. I'm the Atlantis is here lady. I'm the Atlantis in the Baltic. And God damn it, if you don't believe me, go to hell.
Yeah.
I'm open to anything, you know? I mean, where the Rishat structure is located in Mauritania, well, we know for a fact that was a fertile, you know, marsh and river, you know, embedded system at least 12,000 years ago. So it begs the question, and I say this in that chapter, you know, was this actually, you know, part of the Atlantean Empire? It's technically also, depending on how you interpret in front of, it is in front of the Pillars of Hercules in some way. But it's not an island. And again, I'm open to the fact that perhaps that part of the world could have been separated by an ocean, or I wasn't there. But even if that literally is the city Plato was describing, even by his own admission, Atlantis was aware, and by extension, Plato, who told the story through Solon, through the Egyptian priests, of the North American continent. Because he says that in the dialogue, he says, and one could reach the whole of the continent on the opposite end of the true ocean, which is distinct from the small ocean we have, which is inside the Pillars of Hercules. So it's like, that alone is astounding, that in 360 BC, before Columbus, somehow Plato and the Greek world was aware of North America.
Yeah.
Which is astounding, which on its surface, I mean, why is that not taught? And you know, when I read that, it really, all Atlantis aside, it really reminded me of when people who have PhDs in philosophy, when they read that, okay, let's just pretend the whole story in the dialogues is a myth, Anders. It's a myth. Okay, how did he know about North America in 360 BC?
Well, good imagination.
Yeah, explain that to me. Yeah. You know, so it's interesting.
Yeah, it seems as if this ancient empire, or whatever you want to call it, was temporarily very extensive, of course. I mean, yeah. You talk about 70,000 years of existence or something like that. But geographically, it seems to have been also quite extensive. But was it at any point, as far as you've understood from your research, as globally integrated as we are today? Because, I mean, in my view, at least, some people don't agree, but I think that we are, for the first time in recorded history, integrating. If we're not integrated as yet, we are integrating completely, because absolutely, we know what's happening on the other end of the planet in real time. But was it that big at any point, do you think?
Oh, yeah. Oh, in Frederick Oliver's account, well, I'll try to bring you up to that time. So, and you have to. Yeah,
you can just walk us through the whole little story of Atlantis. When did it begin? Well, did it take over from Lemuria or whatever? And then how many rises and how many falls, and how big did it get and all that? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in Edgar Cayce's account, he says, you know, there's an indefinite origin point where, you know, 10.5 million years ago, humanity incarnated on Earth. Again, it's very difficult to talk about this part because it's even he doesn't have the language to describe it. So I only talk about things I can prove.
Yeah, but when I hear those things, I get goosebumps. I think it's very fascinating. So to me, it's
fascinating. So in that time, God only knows, you know, and then
literally
the timeline,
perhaps.
God only knows. Exactly. God only knows. But that's not Atlantis. For Cayce, Atlantis doesn't really begin in earnest. And even this is difficult to point down because you have to use a lot of readings and kind of deduce, because a lot of times people didn't ask him straight questions. They weren't even interested. They were asking about their, you know, mental disorder. And he would say, well, you have to go back to the third destruction of Atlantis to solve that problem in 1940 because you did this. And they're like, what? Like, I'm not Atlantis. Like, what are you talking about? It was a housewife in Virginia, you know, who was a Christian. And so it's so frustrating because you wish, you know, people had asked him such more specific questions. But when they did ask him specific questions, he gave very interesting answers. And so one person straight asked him, describe the entire history of the culture you call Atlantis. And it was this like 2-hour, you know, hypnagogic trance session probably that was, you know, stenographically recorded. And so in that story, he says basically, somewhere before 50,000 BC, on what was probably the Mid-Atlantic Ridge and other associated land masses in the middle of the Atlantic that were above seawater 60,000, 70,000 years ago, there was the beginnings of a culture that later turned into what we would call Atlantis. But even this is difficult because Cayce said, you know, at the beginnings, it was just basically primitive people, you know, but by 50,000 BC, they had reached a quite high level of technology, not the highest, and in a different way. You know, it'd almost be like if we rebooted the simulation of, say, the 19th and 20th centuries, maybe flight would look different. It wouldn't look exactly the way, you know, Wright brothers, propeller, jet. It would be like something a little different.
Yeah.
And so it's different, kind of like
different energy sources, perhaps, or things like that.
Exactly. So in Casey's first iteration, they have things like balloons and flying machines, but they're more like a steampunk type vibe and culture. It's like, it's different. And then that culture is destroyed by the misapplication of a directed energy weapon that they were trying to use to combat megafauna. And he's very specific. It's one of the weirdest readings. I had to read it like five times to go, like, is he really saying in 1923 that the people in this culture, in fact, he says it was a global meeting because the world was overrun with megafauna. And it was overrun by megafauna.
Well, we see the skeleton. We see the remnants of that. So,
and what's fascinating is that he says in 50,722 BC, he's talking to a guy. He says, you were part of a diplomatic mission to combat the animal menace. And you guys, in your stupidity, decided to basically use some sort of harp or stratospheric-based weapon. It's not clear if it was from the stratosphere or from Earth and bounced. I've read that reading like 20 times. It's not clear to me. But in any case, some sort of energy weapon, laser something, that he says was used, and it went into the volcanic flows around the food supplies of these megafauna population centers that they were trying to reduce. That's all he says. But again, as fantastical as that sounds, I tried to show in each case where I cite a channeled reading, either there's no evidence, there's a little evidence and it's not good, or, you know, there's fairly good evidence to support even the most fantastical claim. And in that case, I would say there's a more than good evidence, because in the Journal of Quaternary Science, which is a mainstream peer-reviewed, you know, zoology journal, they say there's an unknown megafaunal extinction spike at 50,000 BC plus or minus 100 years. And it's like, they didn't know that in 1923. So if he's making these wild guesses, he's, again, like Oliver, he's guessing within the acceptable bounds of peer-reviewed history. Now, they say, we think it's due to human hunting, but that's a problem for us because there shouldn't be enough people in advanced hunting.
I think it's a ridiculous theory. And that there are two events of extinction of megafauna, or more perhaps. But one is, as you say, 50,000 BC or something like that. And the other one is just around the Younger Dryas period, 12,000 years ago. There's another one. So,
well, and also, speaking of the Younger Dryas, which is officially, you know, let's say ends in 9600 BC, how did Plato know about that? Because that's exactly the date he gave for the fall of Atlantis. Again, he knew about that. He knew the Holocene era began 9600 BC, and he also knew about the North American continent. So again, even if this is a myth, the Egyptians that told Solon, who told Plato, were aware of this. The other thing they were aware of is in the beginning of that dialogue, they describe a celestial body hitting Earth and burning up everything on it. So it's like, that's also a part of it. And they tell the Greeks, you know, you've immortalized this in your myth of Phaeton, but it's not a myth. It's a real story, and it signifies when heavenly bodies lose orbit and hit the Earth and burn up everything upon it.
Yeah, but that was an artificial body, wasn't it? I mean, an artificial moon or something like that? That was a bit strange to understand when I read the book. But
well, that was from a later
channeling
from a 20th century channeler who I'm not going to say no faith, but this person could have watched Star Wars and said,
let's not go down that.
No. But
so,
you know, there is evidence that some body, artificial or more likely a natural asteroid, or whether that asteroid was, you know, manipulated to hit the Earth by the technology of the time, regardless. But there is some sort of evidence that's more than just speculative that the Earth was struck by a celestial body, as the Egyptian priest told Solon, you know, 2,500 years ago.
Yeah.
And again, Edgar Cayce, who had never studied Egyptology, who had never read anything but the Bible and the newspaper, according to every witness that knew him, he somehow knew that after the final destruction of Atlantis, which he in waking life knew literally nothing about, but in his hypnagogic trance had access to the Akashic records and would tell these fantastical things that later I corroborated with hard evidence. But in Cayce's story, the pre-dynastic Egypt, which went back 10,500 BC to the time that, you know, a lot of people think the pyramids were built and the Sphinx was built, which Cayce himself said specifically the pyramid was built, completed in 10,390 BC by the combined alliance of Atlantean refugees, indigenous Egyptians, and outside forces from the, you know, region. In Cayce's account, that actually is what these highly advanced from nothing cultures are reboots of the Atlantean main culture that was, in his estimation, the highest civilization in the world.
Please walk us through. I mean, I know you don't have very much time today, so maybe we can do this once again and as a sequel.
Absolutely.
We'll see. But walk us through the what you're mentioning, talking about here now, the great exodus after the last destruction of Atlantis, like something like 10,500 BC. That's around the Younger Dryas period there. We know that something dramatic happened. We know that from ice cores in Greenland and Antarctica that climate was first very fast, got hotter very fast, and then it got colder very fast again. It was like a mini ice age. And anyway, so that was the collapse, and the sea level rose dramatically, and maybe also the seafloor sunk, because, I mean, that's also possible. Right. And there are so many theories.
Well, and that's
maybe the Earth actually opened up also, and there are theories all over the place. So anything can happen. But anyway, so surviving, according to, as far as I understand, surviving Atlanteans, as you were mentioning here, they supposedly escaped like to places like Peru, that what we now call Peru, and the Pyrenees, like the Basque Country, which is fascinating, but also and other colonies, primarily, most prominently Egypt, which was then called Khem or Chem, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Do a deep dive into the Giza pyramids there. Are those pyramids and other megalithic sites the smoking guns of Atlantis, would you say?
Well, you know, I just repeat what I can prove, you know.
What do you think? What do you think?
Well, what I think is that the same person that was so accurate in real life with medical remote diagnosis, who could find missing treasure, who had people from Woodrow Wilson to politicians, from bankers, from Wall Street executives, from Henry Ford getting life readings and business readings, that trusted him with major things. If that same person who had no knowledge of this said the pyramid was completed in 10,390 BC, and he said this in 1932, he said this before Graham Hancock, before Robert Bovall, before anyone, to my knowledge, was putting these dates on the map. And he had no interest in the subject. He didn't make any money off this. He just said, look, this is what happened. Then to me, it's very weird, because that's what, in many cases, you know, later research is starting to show. Now, can I prove? Can I go to Giza and take a sample of the limestone and say, oh, this is a tent? No, that's really difficult to do. What we can do, though, is say, well, what did the Egyptians themselves say about that structure? Well, nothing. There is no record of it, which leads you to believe it actually is older. And then you look at the alignment of it. And again, is this true or not? I don't know. Robert Bovall thinks those three are aligned to 10,500, 10,450 BC. To the constellation Orion, as it would have appeared in the precession of the equinoxes at that time. So again, how did Cayce guess that date? That's very strange. You know, the other thing would be, in the Egyptian Turin Kings list, which was written 800 years before Plato's dialogues, you know, somewhere in the 12th century BC, they even say, you know, somewhere around 9,800 BC, you know, the reign of the demigods in the land to the west and the story of Thoth and things like this. And it's like, well, and then who told Solon? The Egyptians. So it's like, that would make sense that at that time they came from Atlantis. But again, it's not even that these were, as you mentioned correctly, these were not isolated things. And it's like, Atlantis is sinking today. Anders, let's go. Let's get in the boat. We got to go find a place. They had already mapped the world. They had already been living, exchanging, working in these areas. So for them, it was like, you know, if we knew America was going to fall into the ocean or something, or a cataclysm was coming, we would already have Greenland and a place like mapped out. We're going to go there because it's geologically stable, or we're going to go build a, you know, arc-like structure called the pyramids and use that as a last redoubt, as I named that chapter, to wait out this cataclysm, restart society. And that's what Casey said they did. In fact, his most detailed readings are about the Atlantean reboot called Giza. And it's a fascinating story because it's like you have invaders from the outside. You have the Atlanteans who come with their hybrid mutant slaves that they've geoengineered in the island, who have to reacculturate to society because a new faction doesn't want them to be slaves. And he's describing laser, you know, hand removal of laser. Basically, he's describing a lightsaber in 1920 before the franchise was created, because he says you're using the bloodless knife that cauterizes as it cuts to cut the hand of a, you know, hybrid man off and replace it with a true hand so that he can, you know, reintegrate into society. And it's like people listening to this in 1932 in Virginia Beach who were devout Baptists were like, what the hell are you talking about, man? I just want to know how to be a better Christian. And he's like, well, that is what I'm getting. You asked me what your past life was. Your past life was a hybrid animal slave who was taken from Atlantis to Egypt. And then you had to go through a surgical reacculturation. I have a whole chapter on that. And it's really, I mean, many other people, though, that channel that subject, whether they've read Casey or not, I mean, those aren't easy Casey readings to access. You have to go into the archive. You have to look really deep. They're not like in a casual book on Edgar Casey. Some of these readings were never published before. And yet they all start to say the same thing.
That do you think that they built the pyramid, the Great Pyramid at Giza, to replicate the so-called Tuoi stone? Is it pronounced that way, Tuoi?
Oh, that's really interesting.
That they had on Poseid, the main that's island, really, because that was also some kind of a power generator, very, very powerful, that's right. Such. And many think, including Christopher Dunn, of course, that the Great Pyramid is also some kind of a power station or used to be.
Sure.
So do you think that was the reason why they, built it?
I think it was multiple reasons. I think that structure has, you know, confused people for so long because I think it was a multi-purpose fortress. You know, on the one hand, it's like you need a place that's impregnable for your ruling class, or just for, you know, in the inevitable event of a cataclysm, that would be the best place to be. According to Casey, yeah, it was a power source, but also, you know, it probably was a, according to many researchers today, you know, a geostabilizing structure. Because it's in the center of the Earth. If you map the Earth, Giza is technically the center, bisects the hemispheres, that point. And, you know, as Dunn and others have mentioned, with like the piezoelectric effect that could be, you know, but some people have suggested that, you know, it actually is beneficial, even as it exists today, just the physical structure existing there without the technology that Dunn thinks was, you know, lost or destroyed in the ages, that it does play a stabilizing role for that region. And that's why it was chosen, was to, this would be the best place to reboot. And also, again, remember, when that was 10,500 years ago, Giza would have looked like, you know, Yucatan, Mexico. Mm. It would have been a very beautiful, green, temperate, not even as hot as Yucatan is today, place with rivers and water. It wouldn't be a barren desert. You know, that's why when I get frustrated, it's like, yes, today it's a barren desert and it's just this, you know, beautiful but very weathered brown block of wood. Well, in those days, in fact, up to, you know, recently modern times, you know, a few hundred years ago, what was it when the Cairo earthquake destroyed Cairo and they had to take all the limestone blocks off? Yeah. Mm-hmm. It would have been an absolutely astounding sight, is a shimmering white pillar in the middle of this region. So I think we have to consider the possibility that until anybody can sufficiently prove that this was a dynastic Egyptian construction, that the possibility absolutely exists that it could be older. Because again, what is the proof that it was a dynastic Egyptian structure?
Nothing.
Howard Weiss's cartouche that he found, that's Khufu, that he could have written. I mean, you built the biggest structure in that region, arguably in the world, the most difficult architectural structure in the world, I would argue, to build, and we don't have a record of it.
No, I agree. Well, I know that we have to wrap this up soon, but just one question that I need to ask about this, because, I mean, obviously after they, I mean, let's assume then that the pyramids and other megalithic structures were built much earlier than we are led to believe, like, say, it was built like 10,000 years ago or 11,000 years ago. Then in Egypt and other places, obviously the knowledge and the technology, not least, obviously waned gradually. And then there was a restart, a reboot, like 5,000 years later or 4,000 years later. How would you explain that? That, I mean, Robert Schoch talks about the solar-induced dark age. I don't know if you have any theories about what happened in the parentheses between the last reboot of Atlantis and the restart of civilization.
No, and in fact, that actually has been a subject of great interest to me, because I'm just as curious as you. And yeah, I am familiar with Robert Schoch's theory of that solar event. And I think it's compelling. I mean, look, I cite in the book when the Dark Ages, you know, let's say you want to call that the 6th century BC, late 5th century BC. But when the Dark Ages, which are a, you know, studied contemporary historical time period, when they began, I think it's in 535. In 535 AD, you know, let's say 35, 40 years after the fall, official fall of the Roman Empire.
I think there's one event called the Charlemagne event.
Two super volcanic explosions.
Oh, volcanic.
For 18 months, and one third of the world's population starves. You know, and it's like, we didn't even know that was provable until, I think, the 20th century. People who read that account in the 18th, 19th century thought, all right, this is like superstition. This is a priest, you know, Joseph of Ephesus writing some BS, a vision he had. It's like, no, there were two super volcanic explosions in 535 AD that basically dimmed the entire world for 18 months. And people at the end of it were so depressed that they thought, like, the world is ending. So it's like, we have records of situations like that already. And then you mentioned Thera. That destroyed that area. And again, blackened the sky for months and months. So who's to say if something even more extreme happened, like you mentioned Robert Schoch's theory, that even a society that, let's say, had rebooted and, you know, consolidated some level of its former infrastructure in, say, Giza, for a small group of people and was rebuilding, wasn't, you know, aborted by another cataclysm, you know? Because again, it's really interesting to me that you could get to that point, let's say, of building the pyramid in 10,400 BC with, you know, levitation technology and magnetic resonance and all this, and presumably flying machines at that time, according to Casey, and then lose it all. Yeah. But, you know, let's say from 10,000 BC to the beginning of dynastic Egypt, thousands of, you know, millennia later, that's a long time. A lot can happen in those intervening years, and we don't know much about those times. You know, that's still a black hole. Like, between Sumeria and that's like, who knows?
It is a black hole. Who knows?
And maybe they just went to, you know, into those early Sumerian cultures that were nearby. I don't know. It's a subject I'm actually investigating right now, perhaps for another book, because you know, Escape from Atlantis, you know, that would be the title.
That would be
fantastic.
Know,
but yeah, because it's interesting. It's interesting. It's and Michael, thank you so much. I really
there are so many more questions to ask. Hopefully we can do a part two at some point. Who knows?
Absolutely.
So where can people go if they want to know more about you and your work and your book, of course?
Yeah, you can go to Michael Leflem, one word, .com. And you can see if you're interested in reading A Dweller on Two Planets or any of the other older sources, I've got a resources page at the end. So you can get some really interesting kind of rare PDFs that I've uploaded to a jump drive or a Google Drive. It's really interesting. And then the book is available, Visions of Atlantis, Reclaiming Our Lost Ancient Legacy. It's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and also internationally in different bookstores now. So you might just Google it and it'll pop up on whatever is convenient now. And yeah, so excellent. I think I really appreciate it. And I'm just glad to see, you know, that there are intelligent people who have open minds, because I don't presume to have found Atlantis. You know, that was never my goal. My goal was to show you, look, this is how history is actually performed. You know, this is how it should be done, with an open scientific approach that doesn't preclude the possibility of a perhaps timeline that needs to be revised. And this is what people who think we're crazy think, but they don't have any more evidence than we do.
No, no,
you know?
Exactly.
And I always tell people, don't be afraid of these, you know, Michael Shermers and all these people, because they don't really know what they're talking about. No. They're just annoyed that their little world is being upset by people who they believe are using unscientific methods, when ironically,
subject for another talk, maybe, because that's, yeah, we could talk about just that, the psychology of debunking, as you were talking about before this interview.
Sure. We'll do that next time.
next time. Okay. It's been a ride and a true joy to have you on the show. Good luck with your Indiana Jones quest for our lost world.
Thank you so much, Anders. I really appreciate it. And I'll talk to you soon.